Good morning. Israel tried to kill Hamas leaders in an attack on Qatar, a U.S. ally and the mediator for ceasefire negotiations. We'll hear from a Qatari official on how they plan to respond on this hour of Morning Edition from NPR News. RFK Jr.'s Make America Healthy Again Commission has 128 ideas on how to improve children's health, but not a lot of details on how to get them done. I'm Layla Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin. A lot of the proposals focus on diet and exercise. Also, if you're planning on college, what's your dream school? Our guest this morning says it might not be the one you think. We have tips on finding the right fit. It is Wednesday, September 10th. Answer: on this day in 1984, this host started his 37-year run on Jeopardy. Question: who is Alex Trebek? News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. NATO aircraft and Polish aircraft scrambled fighter jets today to shoot down drones that entered Polish airspace. The drones are Russian. NPR's Rob Schmitz reports the Polish government is calling the drone incursion an act of aggression.
Poland's Prime Minister Donald Tusk says he's in contact with NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte and that he's called for an emergency meeting of Poland's Council of Ministers. An operation is underway related to the repeated violation of Polish airspace, posted Tusk on social media. He went on to say Poland's military shot down some of the drones that entered both Poland's and NATO airspace and that a search was underway to locate them. Most of Ukraine, including areas that border Poland, was under air raid alerts nearly all night, according to Ukraine's Air Force. Rob Schmitz, NPR News, Berlin.
Israel is defending yesterday's strike in the capital of Qatar. This was aimed at top Hamas leaders. The Israeli strike has been condemned by several nations, and President Trump has criticized it. Israel says it will act against its enemies anywhere. It told Hamas to release all hostages, or they will be killed, the leaders, that is, and Gaza will be destroyed. The U.S. Supreme Court will take up President Trump's tariffs in early November. At issue is a question about congressional versus presidential authority. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports opponents of the tariffs say only Congress has the power to manage tariffs and the president can only step in when Congress allows.
In establishing the tariffs, they contend that Trump has vastly exceeded any power delegated to him by Congress under various statutes. A dozen states have joined the fight against the tariffs, too, arguing that contrary to Trump's argument that the tariffs are aimed at preventing illegal fentanyl imports, the tariff statutes do not authorize such a tenuous connection to commerce. Taxing tomatoes, they say, does not deal with fentanyl.
NPR's Nina Totenberg reporting. The Missouri State House has advanced a plan to redraw the state's congressional voting map. President Trump has demanded this. The measure goes next to the Missouri State Senate. From St. Louis Public Radio, Brian Munoz has more.
Republicans say what they're calling the Missouri First map better reflects the will of the state's mostly Republican voters in next year's midterm election. Democrats, however, warn it could unfairly favor the GOP and dilute the power of Kansas City voters. Ashley Onney is the House Minority Leader.
We knew coming into this special session we would lose. We knew that. But we showed up, and we will keep showing up, because the fight didn't end today. There's a lot of fight left. Missouri's just the latest, but it's happening all over the country.
The bill now moves to the Missouri Senate, where it is expected to pass later this week. For NPR News, I'm Brian Munoz in Jefferson City, Missouri.
Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has released a broad strategy about children's health. The report is getting mixed reviews from public health experts. This is NPR. The movie The Conjuring: Last Rites resuscitated the box office over the weekend. NPR's Mandalay Del Barco reports it has now become the top horror movie opening ever.
In the latest Conjuring movie, the fourth in the franchise, paranormal investigators and demonologists Ed and Lorraine Warren confront a family's haunted house.
There's an evil here.
Bobby Bagby Ford, who heads B&B Theaters, says the supernatural horror movie became a surprising smash hit.
It really became a cultural event, and so we're really excited. It really changed the trajectory of September.
Analysts had predicted a sleepy September at the box office after a somewhat slow summer, but on opening weekend, Conjuring: Last Rites conjured $194 million globally. The momentum could continue next weekend with the anime movie Demon Slayer Infinity Castle, and in the fall, Wicked for Good and the new Avatar movie Fire and Ash. Mandalit Del Barco, NPR News.
A federal court has ruled embattled Federal Reserve Governor Lisa Cook can remain in her position. That's while she fights President Trump's efforts to fire her. A former figure in the Iran-Contra affair, retired Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North, has married his former secretary, Fawn Hall. She shredded documents to help him in the scandal. That's when the Reagan administration sold weapons to Iran to fund anti-communist rebels, the Contras, in Nicaragua. North was convicted for his role, but the convictions were later overturned. Both North and Hall had been widowed. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. RWJF is a national philanthropy working toward a future where health is no longer a privilege, but a right. Learn more at rwjf.org.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 seconds.
Vernie Quick loved the simple things in life. Growing up along the North Shore, he spent his afternoons on his rowboat, fly fishing and painting. After graduating high school, Vernie moved to Boston, Massachusetts to pursue his love for art. It was there that Vernie was introduced to several art colonies. Within them, he found belonging, collaboration, and the focus he needed to grow as a painter. And Vernie suddenly had this brainchild that his hometown would also be an ideal place to establish an art colony. His artwork soon gained attention, and it wasn't long before his notoriety landed Vernie a job back in Minnesota. He later became an instructor at the Minneapolis College of Art and Design. Determined to give his students the same freedom and inspiration he found, he brought a group of them up at the North Shore for an 8-week summer intensive. They all worked odd jobs and were housed by local residents. Their classroom, the rugged landscapes of Grand Marais. And the summer experiment soon blossomed into Minnesota's first ever art colony.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
This morning edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. The suburbs of Qatar's capital, Doha, were rocked with explosions yesterday after Israel bombed Hamas's office and its residences there.
It marks the first attack of its kind by Israel on Qatar, a U.S. ally that's been hosting Hamas leaders in exile and is a mediator in the war in Gaza. In a few minutes, we'll hear directly from an official with the Qatari government on how they plan to respond. But first,
here to tell us more about the attack and the fallout is NPR international correspondent Aya Batraoui, who is in Doha this morning. Aya, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Michelle.
So could you just start with explaining what exactly happened in Qatar yesterday?
Sure. So it was just before 4 p.m. here when explosions rang out in the capital in several locations. Videos showed pedestrians screaming and running for cover on the street. And Doha is a city where the last FIFA World Cup was played. It's a major international travel hub. And this is where Trump came in May and lavished praise on the leadership here because it hosts thousands of U.S. troops. So this was a stunning attack. And Israel's military claimed responsibility for it, saying it was targeting senior Hamas leaders who it says were, quote, directly responsible for the October 7th attack of 2023 on Israel. Now, one of the bombings targeted Hamas's office here in Doha. This is where I and other reporters have sat in interviews with the group's political leaders, some of whom say the decision to attack Israel actually came from its military wing inside Gaza on October 7th, not from them, that they did not have prior knowledge of it. Either way, Israel missed its target. It did not kill any senior Hamas officials. Instead, it killed 6 people, according to Hamas, among them a Hamas official's son, the head of his office, 3 others with no titles with Hamas, and a Qatari security officer.
And what is Qatar saying about this attack?
Well, Qatar's prime minister describes this as state terrorism. And Qataris say they had no forewarning of the attack. So speaking from a podium last night, Qatar's prime minister said the attack on Qatar's soil is a message to the region that Israel is a rogue player and that this attack is proof that Israel has worked to sabotage every attempt to achieve peace. And here I'll note that Qatar says its role as mediator and as host of Hamas's political leaders in exile has long been at the behest of successive U.S. administrations. And also keep in mind that for nearly 2 years now, Qatar and Egypt have served as mediators between Israel and Hamas, hosting both sides in talks, some of them here at hotels in Doha, where mediators shuffle between floors to deliver messages between the two sides. And they've successfully mediated during Israel's war in Gaza the release of Israeli hostages and Palestinian detainees, though a deal to end the war remains out of reach. Now, it is hard to see how Qatar might actually come and host Israel's top security brass here again after these attacks, or if Hamas would remain in Doha, especially given that Israel did not achieve its mission here.
So as we understand this, Israel just tried to kill the Hamas officials who are responsible for negotiating ceasefire proposals, if I have that right. So how might this attack affect those efforts to end the war in Gaza?
That is correct, yeah. And this was a unilateral Israeli decision, according to President Trump. He spoke with Qatar's emir after the attack yesterday and said the U.S. was not on board with it. Now, what we're hearing from Israeli officials like the defense minister and others is they're calling this now a, quote, message. They say Israel will continue to pursue Hamas and that if the group does not surrender, they and Gaza will be annihilated. So what this means for the war is that for people in Gaza, they're suffering displacement. The killing of civilians every day continues with no end in sight. And the families of Israeli hostages still held in Gaza say the chance of bringing them back now faces greater uncertainty than ever before.
That is NPR international correspondent Aya Bertrawi. Aya, thank you.
Thank you, Michelle.
For more on this, we now turn to the advisor to Qatar's prime minister and the official spokesperson for the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Majid Al-Ansari. He's on the line from Doha in Qatar. Mr. Ansari, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Does Qatar plan to respond to Israel's attack on your country?
We have taken all measures to respond to this flagrant attack against our sovereignty. We have established a legal team headed by the Minister of State, Dr. Al-Khlaifi, to discuss all possible legal and diplomatic avenues where we can address this attack. We have already sent a letter to the UN Security Council, and there will be a session by the Security Council over this, and we are talking to all of our partners in the region and beyond to take a very strong position against the actions of Prime Minister Netanyahu that has driven Israel into being a pariah and rogue state in the region. And we want to make it very clear that this will never happen again. And we will not allow the Prime Minister Netanyahu to endanger the lives not only of Qatari, the residents living here in Qatar, but the region as a whole. He is a saboteur in chief. Responsible for sabotaging any chance of peace in the region. And the biggest message yet is bombing the mediator in order to send a very clear message that even those who work for the cause of peace are now targets.
Well, let me ask you about that. I mean, the Hamas political office was set up in your country over a decade ago at the behest of the United States, and Qatar's role as a negotiator with the group was requested by successive U.S. administrations. After this attack, will Qatar continue to play the role of negotiator if it makes your country unsafe?
You know, it will take more than an international bully like Prime Minister Netanyahu to change the DNA of the Qatari people. We have always been powers for peace. We have always been facilitating and mediating for peaceful outcomes. This is part of our constitution. It is part of our national identity, and it will remain so.
Will you continue to mediate on this ceasefire deal? Are prospects for peace going to continue through Qatar?
Obviously, when one party asks us to deliver a proposal to the other side, and then when we start meeting with the other side for these proposals, they bomb our country, they bomb the mediator and the places where the talks were taking place. It sends a very clear message that there is nothing valid in the talks right now. We will not stop our efforts to end the genocide of the people of Gaza, end the crimes of Prime Minister Netanyahu over the peoples of the region in Lebanon and Syria and in Palestine and now in Qatar. But we are now, of course, assessing the situation. We're talking to our partners internationally to assure them that Prime Minister Netanyahu has been always there at the curb at any chance of peace to derail the talks, either by assassinating people on the other side or, as we have seen now, by attacking the mediators themselves with impunity.
You call Prime Minister Netanyahu a bully. Given how you describe him, will Hamas officials remain in Qatar if they're a target? If they're a target of Israel, will Hamas officials remain in Qatar?
This is a decision to be taken by the highest echelons of leadership here in Qatar. At the moment, what we are busy with is our security forces and MOI, Ministry of Interior forces, and the Civil Defense Forces, and the ISF, the Internal Security Force, are all there in the location constantly since this attack happened, trying to identify the fallen Qatari security force people and the who are there in the location. We are concerned right now with our own national security, with the safety of people here in Doha, and making sure that everything that can be taken as a precaution is taken right now in that location and beyond. And I think there will be a moment where the political decisions will be taken on a lot of issues, but right now our main focus is on our sovereignty, our national security, and in making sure that this attack does not go unanswered.
The U.S. seemed largely caught off guard by this attack. President Trump said he was very unhappy about it and called Qatar's emir to assure him it would never happen again. The White House also said they warned your government through U.S. Envoy Steve Witkoff that the attack was coming. You disputed that online. Did the U.S. warn Qatar or did it not?
The call that came to Qatar was 10 minutes after the attack. There was no warning before the attack, and as we have heard from our interlocutors in the U.S. and the call that was made yesterday, the warning by Israel to the U.S. did not come before the attack, and therefore there was no way for the U.S. to warn us, but they have immediately called us 10 minutes after the attack to inform us of its happening. So this was a treacherous attack. There was absolutely no warning, and the region, the neighborhood where this attack happened, is a residential neighborhood where the location was known by your reporters and other people around Doha very openly, where the talks were taking place with the Hamas delegation. So it was not a secret location or a hidden location. A neighborhood includes a lot of diplomatic installations, embassies and such, and the schools and nurseries right next to that building. So we've conveyed all of this to the U.S. side, and we have received very clear confirmation that the U.S. was not consulted about this attack, does not condone this attack, and that the U.S. will make sure that it doesn't happen again through its partnership with Qatar.
How will it assure, I mean, the president called the emir to assure it would never not happen again, but how will the U.S. assure that it won't happen again if it didn't want it to happen in the first place?
I mean, I would ask that question of the Trump administration, but we have full trust that working with the administration in the past has made a lot of our security strategic positions stronger, and it's something it's a partnership that we believe in with the U.S. The institutional relationship between Qatar and the U.S. has always been strong, and we rely on our partners in the U.S. to make sure that Netanyahu is kept at bay and is no longer able to throw the whole region into chaos. This is a warmonger that is basing his policy decisions around the region on narcissism and political ambitions that don't go beyond staying in power for no more than 1 month. And as an international community, with the help of the U.S., we want to work to make sure that he is never able to do that again.
That's Majid Al-Ansari, advisor to Qatar's prime minister and official spokesperson for the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Thank you for your time. This is NPR News.
KEXE was first on the air in 1976. Recently, a couple of the founders, Rich and Susie McClear, stopped by to talk about why KEXE was needed then.
A lot of people were up here thinking they were doing their own thing. And when the radio station came on the air, they found a neighbor was doing the same thing, or somebody across town, and it magically became a, there are a lot of us up here that have the same thoughts, the same activities.
Neighbors talking to neighbors. We help them get in contact with each other and talk to each other about common problems.
KEXE is still needed now. We're connected through green cheese trivia, through great music and events. We're in crisis mode. We have had all of our funding cut from the federal government. Please help us out. You can text the word donate to 218-326-1234. I'm Heidi Holton. Thank you so much for your support.
It comes from this station and from Subaru, featuring the 2025 Subaru Outback with standard symmetrical all-wheel drive and up to 9.5 inches of ground clearance. Learn more at Subaru.com/Outback. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at WaltonFamilyFoundation.org. From Avalara, providing businesses with cloud-based tools and managed services for property tax compliance. From filing returns to tracking assessments, learn more at avalara.com/property tax. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. What if I told you that elite doesn't mean best, that the dream school you have in mind for you or your child's college education doesn't exist? In other words, that there is not a single perfect, ideally prestigious match for you or your kid that will put you on a trajectory for lifetime success. And oh, by the way, if you think the whole college admissions process is crazy, you're not crazy. It really is. All that is according to journalist and author Jeffrey Salingo, who has spent many years reporting on the inner workings of higher ed admissions. He writes about all this in his latest book, Dream School, Finding the College That's Right for You, and he's with us now. Jeffrey Salingo, thanks so much for joining us.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
So first, let's talk about just how crazy college admissions has gotten. Without giving my age, I applied to 4 schools. Those were the schools my college advisor told me to apply to. I did. You did the same, what, 4?
4 colleges.
4 schools. Yep. So why is it now people are applying to 30?
Well, I've worked in and around higher ed for nearly 30 years, and I could say this with certainty, that we kind of lost our way. We don't think about purpose anymore in higher ed. We think about prestige. And so what's happened just in the last 20 years is that the number of applications filed to the most selective colleges and universities have gone from about 600,000 applications to nearly 2 million applications.
You're saying the size of their freshman classes has stayed flat at around 100,000 in total, but also the number of high school seniors in the United States has not grown by that much. So the number of these applications cannot be attributed to the fact that there are more humans in the world.
Exactly. And we've gone over, just the Common App this year went over 10 million applications overall, where again, the number of seniors has remained consistent. Everybody just keeps applying to more colleges. And they're kind of forgetting, by the way, that the average acceptance rate in the United States of a U.S. college is 65%. Most colleges accept most students. But we keep coming back to this idea that prestige matters. And we know that success is not exclusive to just the Ivy League.
Well, the other thing you point out in the book, though, it isn't just that the most selective colleges are getting this huge increase in applications.
Yes, everyone's getting them, but they mostly want the most selective. So then what happens is, who says yes to a acceptance offer? And so yield, that's the percentage of students that actually say yes to a college when they get accepted, those numbers have been falling except at the most prestigious colleges.
Forgive me for putting it in such crass terms, but whose fault is this? Because it feels like it should be somebody's fault. Is it these rankings that famously seem to exist only to rank colleges and they rank them according to selectivity? Or is it something else? Is it just this is actually an affluent country and when you have more money, you tend to go to college?
Well, I'm not trying to get out of the question, but everyone's to blame, right? So we have the Common App, which makes it now easier to apply to college with essentially a press a button. Rankings are to blame because everyone is trying to move up in the rankings. Colleges are to blame because they keep adding different rounds to admissions. So now we have early action and early decision, and they're trying to make students commit earlier than ever before if they get in. And then finally, at the end of the day, it's really the families. At some point, somebody has to say, stop. And this is what I'm trying to do with this book, is I'm trying to give parents permission to say it's okay to think more broadly about what signals a good college. Student engagement is actually higher at some less selective colleges than it's at higher selective colleges.
Let me just ask one more question about this sort of upward pressure on applications. Some parts of the world have gotten a lot more affluent than they were, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago. And it's a sensitive subject right now because international students are under such a spotlight, some of it quite negative from the current administration. But does an influx of applications from international students, many of whom pay full price, is that also a factor on this sort of upward pressure on applications?
Oh, there's no doubt about it that international students over the last 20 or 30 years have taken spots from domestic students, which is why people worry about the number of international students at American universities. But the problem is that, again, we keep thinking that the only place to get a good education is at these elite schools, and that's just not true.
There has been tremendous legal and political energy around affirmative action in recent years. There's this attitude that these unqualified Black and Latino kids are taking up all the spots.
In my last book, I was embedded in three selective colleges. And I will tell you, and this was what really frustrated me during the oral arguments in the Supreme Court a couple of years ago in the affirmative action case, is it just doesn't happen. Do they talk about race and income and ethnicity? Yes, they do. But they do it at the very end when they're trying to balance a class. And that's when you have highly qualified students from all different kinds of backgrounds. And you're saying as an institution, as is your right, by the way, with institutional autonomy, that we think diversity is important.
I noticed that in your book, you didn't identify anybody by race. I mean, you gave some sort of markers about like where people live and what kind of community or what kind of high school they came from. So I'm just asking, like, is this primarily an upper middle class issue?
Well,
here?
The focus on prestigious colleges, yes. Race and class definitely play a role here. Most students are in high schools where they get very little advice about college. There might be one or two counselors for hundreds of students. They're dealing with just, getting the right classes in high school to even get into college. There's all these things people don't know.
What do you hope parents, students, and counselors should look at?
So I want to give them the tools to look beyond kind of the top 25 rankings. And first, what are the colleges and universities that give you a supportive start? 1 in 4 kids are not going to make it to their sophomore year, and only 50% of students even graduate in 4 years. So you want to go to a place that has built-in support structures. Many of these best colleges have orientation throughout the year. So you want to look for something with that first-year experience. They build that scaffolding around you, and then they slowly take it down as you become a sophomore, junior,
and this is senior. Not just kids who are first-gen college
students.
This is everybody.
Everybody needs this now, especially, by the way, post-COVID. A lot of students are coming to college, and they're just not ready. So everybody needs that. Second, where connections are easy. We know that belonging in college matters. Again, it matters to completion. So you want to ask other students about, did they find a mentor in that first year of college? We know that finding a mentor is incredibly important to graduating from college for, again, students at all income levels.
Jeffrey Selingo is the author of Dream School, Finding the College That's Right for You. Jeffrey Selingo, thanks so much for talking to us.
It was great to be here. Thank you.
This is NPR News.
75 years ago this month, a beloved children's book hit the shelves.
Henry Huggins was in the third grade. His hair looked like a scrubbing brush, and most of his grown-up front teeth were in.
We commemorate Beverly Cleary's classic, Henry Huggins, on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
And you can hear All Things Considered later today at 4 o'clock with your local host, Jennifer Barr. You're tuned in to the Wednesday Morning Show here on member-supported KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. After Dark is KXE's Saturday night program after Green Cheese from 9 to midnight, featuring styles of music like punk, metal, EDM, R&B, hip-hop, and more. Interested in hosting? Email dgannon at KAXE.com. www.mixedprecipitationopera.org. Mixed Precipitation Opera and Theater Group presents Pickup Truck Opera Volume 5, Saturday, September 13th at 3 p.m. at the Mask and Rose Theater in Pulaski. The Minnesota Department of Transportation has an open house today at 5:30 about the Grand Rapids-La Prairie Corridor Study. Meet at Yanmar Arena for a brief presentation, followed by an opportunity for questions and feedback. The Virginia Public Library offers a genealogy assistance program the second Thursday of the month at 4 p.m. Whether you are just starting out or fine-tuning your research, all are welcome. Walker Ethnic Fest in downtown Walker is Saturday, September 13th, with food and art from 10 to 5, parade at 11, and live music from noon to 9. Manuman Arts Initiative is hosting an art mini-summit Saturday, September 13th. Local artists are invited to artist presentations, open studios, and vendors. Only 75 guests may attend. Sign up through their Instagram page. The Manuman Arts Initiative is a Minnesota-based organization that operates out of the Gigi Egan in Manoman, Minnesota. Ripple River Gallery, south of Deerwood, hosts the dual exhibit Reclaim Reframe now through September 28th, featuring sculptures from KAXE's own John Bauer, paired with photographs from Rachel Kane. The exhibit proves that one person's trash is another person's treasure. Open Wednesday through Saturday from 10 to 5, and Sundays 11 to 4.
On today's date, September 10th, in 2018, the berries of the three-leaved false Solomon seal are beginning to ripen. The plants don't have a lot of berries, 3, 4, maybe 5, and they're small and round and red, and they look a lot like the berries you might be familiar with that are found on the Canada Mayflower. And the reason for that is they are cousins. The Canada Mayflower is Myanthemum canadensis, and the three-leaf false Solomon seal is Myanthemum trifolia. The three-leaf false Solomon seal is a plant of the swamps, and the berries have little to recommend them. I have tried them, and my initial reaction was, ooh, these are bitter, and they are. They're followed by a tiny amount of sweetness, but not really enough to make me go back for seconds. After tasting one, I decided they can be food for the birds.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from UKG, delivering HR, pay, time, and culture products and services dedicated to helping clients build a great workplace for their people. UKG.com/great. UKG, our purpose is people. And from Easy Cater, committed to helping organizations order and manage food for all their business needs. With online ordering from restaurants nationwide, employee meal programs, and tools to control food expenses at easycater.com.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. The Trump administration has released more than 100 recommendations it says should be taken to improve children's health.
The new Make Our Children Healthy Again strategy is a follow-up to a May report that outlined what it identified as the drivers of chronic health conditions affecting children.
Here to tell us more is NPR health correspondent Maria Godoy. Maria, good morning.
Good morning.
So give us the overview.
So this report serves up a smorgasbord of action items that the administration says should be implemented to increase the health of children. You know, from reinstating the presidential fitness test in schools to promoting breastfeeding. Now, I'd say a hefty portion of the recommendations deal with nutrition, research, and education for kids. But it also calls for studying the root causes of autism and for creating what it calls a new vaccine framework.
Now, Secretary RFK Jr. is a well-known vaccine skeptic. Does this report call for outright changes in vaccine policy?
It calls for making sure that America has, quote, the best childhood vaccine schedule, and it also calls for, quote, addressing vaccine injuries. I spoke with Dr. Peter Hotez with Baylor College of Medicine. Here's what he said.
Addressing vaccine injuries, that has become their euphemism for saying vaccines cause autism or neurodevelopmental disabilities. So it's more the same RFK pseudoscience.
In the past, Kennedy has made statements linking autism with vaccines, even though dozens of studies have thoroughly debunked that claim.
Maria, you mentioned earlier that nutrition is a big focus of this report. And I do have to mention that when former First Lady Michelle Obama tried to call attention to diet and exercise for school kids, some conservatives ridiculed her for it. So what does RFK's report call for?
Well, overall, it puts a big emphasis on physical activity and especially diet in determining the health of kids. And that's something every public health expert I spoke with said was indeed the right place to focus. Dr. Dariush Mazafarian is at Tufts University. He praised the report's broad focus on nutrition. Another action item that Mazafarian applauded from the report was a call to close what's called the generally recognized as safe loophole. It basically allows food companies to use ingredients that have not undergone a formal safety review by doing their own research to declare it safe.
So that's a really, really big deal. Again, overturning, you know, 35 years of basically open door policy for food industry to do whatever it wants with food additives.
But, you know, other public health advocates say that the report is overall light on specific details and does not actually crack down on ultra-processed foods, something that Kennedy has called for repeatedly. And they say that in the big picture, the administration has taken other moves that undermine nutrition. Joel Berg is the CEO of Hunger Free America. He notes that the report calls for serving fresh local produce in schools, but the administration canceled a program that did that.
What didn't we get in this report?
Well, the first MAHA report identified chemical exposures as a driver of chronic illness in kids, but Dr. Philip Landrigan with Boston College said this one was basically silent on those issues.
We know full well that many of the chemicals to which children are exposed are already damaging health. And unfortunately, this report says nothing about controlling or reducing children's exposures to those chemicals that are known to be hazards.
He says the report does not present a comprehensive blueprint for improving the health of America's children.
That is NPR's Maria Godoy. Maria, thank you.
My pleasure.
For more on the report, we're joined now by Barry Popkin. He's a professor of nutrition at the University of North Carolina. Good morning, and thanks for being on the program.
My pleasure.
So the report's stated goal is improving children's health. So if we could just start with how bad children's health is in the United States.
Children's health in America is so bad that we're now seeing diabetes among children and adolescents, whereas 40 years ago, we only saw diabetes among older adults. Mm. So you can just get a sense of the diet-related diseases that are occurring so much earlier, and the diets themselves and the levels of overweight and obesity among our children are so great that we're sure they're ultimately going to have a very high risk for many non-communicable diseases later in life. In other words, it's horrible, and we're doing nothing about it.
Well, this report says it's about tackling those issues that you described, right? Diabetes, obesity, health issues like that. Is it a clear plan to tackle it?
No. It's a very sad day for America. It's all promises, but no teeth.
Mm. And can you say more? I mean, it emphasizes nutrition, lifestyle changes, as we heard.
It's essentially emphasizing things like research, exploration, consideration, but nothing about any regulation or law to mandate change. In a few cases, MAHA's gotten some voluntary changes, which are we know will not last after MAHA's gone, and really don't do very much. But the unhealthy ultra-processed foods and many harmful chemicals will continue to impact our children, our adolescents, our adults, all ages in America.
So what do you want to see put in place to improve childhood nutrition, childhood health?
I'd like to see the FDA put a warning label on unhealthy food. I'd like to see the FTC mandate no advertisements going to children or essentially banning advertisements during a large hunk of the day on unhealthy food that have been identified with these warning labels. And I'd like to see some teeth. All throughout this document, there are nothing. And you can see that the food and agriculture sectors that really profit highly from the ultra-processed food they're selling to our children and killing them at the same time really have gotten to the government, so that they had nothing in this document that will lead to any meaningful regulation, law, or guideline that will improve America's health.
The report calls for access to healthy food through the SNAP Nutrition Program at a time when government funding for that program has been cut. Does the strategy outlined in this report address access when it comes to healthy food?
No. It in no way does anything other than call for X, call for Y, with no indication of a policy that will give money to the school food program, require the school food programs to eliminate ultra-processed foods, which would be the really first step.
Barry Popkin is a professor at the Gillings School of Global Public Health at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Thank you so much for your time. This is NPR News.
You are tuned in to Morning Edition here on the Wednesday Morning Show here on KAXE KBXE, People Powered Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingle. KAXE and Stay Human present The Authentic Voice, a live storytelling concert Saturday, September 20th at 7 p.m. at Clockow Brewing in Grand Rapids. The event features nationally known storyteller Lauren Neamy and some of Stay Human's regular contributors, made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. The Bell Museum's statewide star party is September 18th through the 20th at 24 locations across Minnesota, including the Virginia Public Library, Thursday, September 18th at 3:30, and at the Blackwater Environmental Area in Cohasset at 7 p.m. The Buck Lake Improvement Club has their monthly breakfast buffet Sunday, September 14th at the Buck Lake Community Center, located 12 miles north of Nashwauk on Highway 65. Applications are now open for the University of Minnesota Extension Master Gardener Volunteer Program. Learn how to share science-based horticulture knowledge with people in your area. Course begins in January, and the deadline to apply is October 1st. Visit z.umn.edu or contact your local extension office. United Way of 1000 Lakes has many volunteer opportunities in Itasca County. Find a list and sign up at volunteer.uwlakes.org. Now back to Morning Edition.
That's the Stay Human Band. I'm Michael Goldberg, and some of the storytellers heard on our Stay Human radio show are putting on a concert of live storytelling Saturday, September 20th at Clockow Brewing. Starting at 7 o'clock, the show features nationally known storyteller Lauren Neamy. He's holding a workshop called The Authentic Voice for some of the Stay Human crew, and we'll share the work we've been doing together at this event. I hope I see you there. 7 p.m. Saturday night, September 20th at Clocko Brewing in Grand Rapids. Storytelling to stay human, with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From BetterHelp, committed to helping clients with issues ranging from relationship challenges and goal setting to grief and depression. Learn more at BetterHelp.com/public. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. In less than 48 hours, protesters in Nepal have essentially overthrown the country's political system. Protesters and mobs on Tuesday burnt down most of the country's institutions, including the parliament, the Supreme Court, and even prisons. They also torched the homes of some politicians. The prime minister resigned and remains in hiding. To understand what's happening, we're going to go to NPR's Dia Hadid, who's been following the events in Nepal from her base in Mumbai. Good morning, Dia.
Good morning, Michelle.
So what's happening today?
Well, today in the capital, Kathmandu, our producer, Prasad Sangrula, says it's very calm. The army is patrolling in some sensitive areas. There's a curfew, but the airport spokesman says the airport may reopen soon, which is good news. It was closed owing to smoke smouldering from nearby torched buildings. But some residents say they feel quite unsafe because hundreds of prisoners fled in jailbreaks. And it seems some mobs looted weapons and now the army is trying to get them back.
So is the army now effectively in charge?
The army appears in charge of security. Politically, it appears there's a vacuum. Most of Nepal's political class lost their legitimacy overnight. So the army chief has called on protest leaders to come forward for negotiations. But Karan Pudel, he's the editor of the Kathmandu Journal, says there's a problem. The protest movement was leaderless, and he says that makes him worry that the army might be in charge for a while. And Michelle, please excuse the wobbly line here.
Some fear that the army could take de facto control of the country.
So how real is that fear?
It's a worst-case scenario. Analysts say they're hoping that an interim government can be formed until elections can be called. And one person Nepalis appear to be pinning their hopes on is a popular rapper turned mayor of Kathmandu, the capital. His name is Belendra Shah, and maybe he sniffed the changing political winds because last week he shared an old rap of his. Have a listen. So the chorus goes something like, who will listen to the poor? But Ashish Pradhan of the International Crisis Group says any transition won't be easy.
They have to figure out what comes next, but also managing the hopes and expectations of the people behind this movement that want a really big sea change.
A sea change. And Dio, just remind us, what sparked all this?
Michelle, frustration was brewing for years in Nepal, where most people are deeply poor. Some students funneled that anger by sharing posts that were uploaded by the children of Nepali elites. They were showing off their poolside lifestyles and their swag, like the politician's son who posed near a Christmas tree made of Louis Vuitton boxes. And they hashtag it Nepo Kids Nepal. Then the government banned most social media platforms, ostensibly because they refused to register with the government, but some Nepalis saw it as a ploy to stop their anti-corruption campaign. So on Monday, that's just 2 days ago, students rushed out to the streets to protest. Some tried to breach parliament walls. Security forces opened fire and killed 19 people. Some were students in their uniforms.
And Dia, what about what has happened to these people who've been killed? Do we know?
We spoke to one relative of a slain protester. It seems the bodies have not yet been returned to their families. And there's concern that once they are, that outpouring of grief and anger could trigger even more unrest.
That is NPR's Dia Hadid. Dia, thank you.
You're welcome, Michelle.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel.
Green Cheese listeners know how important it is to support stations like KAXE KBXE.
Anyone who can, be sure to donate, because as all of us know who listen to this, Green Cheese and all the other programming on the stations, we really, really love it and don't want anything to happen to it. So it's really important to give what you can.
One thing I wanted to do is I wanted to talk to everybody out there. Radio is important when it's unique and it's interesting and it's local. And given your current funding situation, everybody out there should be doing something about that, no matter how little it is. If everybody did something, it makes a tremendous difference. Think about Saturday nights with no green cheese. That sounds terrible.
It would be so boring.
This is the queen, and I'm going to make an edict. All cheeses, get your checkbooks out and send in some money to our favorite station and show, and my check will be in the mail tomorrow.
Donate now at KAXE.org.
A court says a president can't just fire a member of America's central bank, which under law has a large degree of insulation from politicians, but this is not likely the final word.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Progressive Insurance, providing direct car insurance rates side by side with other insurance carriers. Customers can see rates and find an option that works for their needs. Now that's Progressive. Learn more at progressive.com.
I'm David Brancaccio in Los Angeles. Federal Reserve Board Governor Lisa Cook can stay in her job pending a possible legal appeal. A federal judge has ruled that Cook can stay while she fights President Trump's efforts to fire her. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer joins us now with more.
Well, David, last night, U.S. District Court Judge Jia Cobb issued a preliminary injunction barring President Trump from ousting Cook. So that means Cook can stay in her job while she fights her dismissal.
What did the judge have to say about assertions that Cook committed mortgage fraud?
Well, the judge said that Cook, quote, made a strong showing that her dismissal would violate the Federal Reserve Act. Now, that law says a Fed governor can only be removed for cause. The judge says that only refers to a Fed governor's behavior while in office. And Cook took out the mortgages in question before becoming a Fed governor. She's denied committing mortgage fraud.
Now, our central bankers, the Fed, they meet next week to possibly lower interest rates. Will Lisa Cook be at that two-day meeting?
As things stand right now, yes. In a statement to Marketplace, her lawyers say Cook will continue to carry out her sworn duties, adding that the ruling, quote, recognizes and reaffirms the importance of safeguarding the independence of the Federal Reserve. The White House also issued a statement, though, saying President Trump lawfully removed Lisa Cook for cause, and, quote, this ruling will not be the last say on the matter.
And meanwhile, the Trump administration's in the process of filling a separate vacancy on the Fed Board of Governors with White House Economic Advisor Stephen Miron.
Yeah, the Senate Banking Committee is scheduled to vote on Miron's nomination today. If he's approved by the committee, his nomination will go before the full Senate for a vote. That could happen quickly, so he too could be at next week's Fed meeting.
All right, Nancy, thank you. Nancy's in Washington. The key index on the Warsaw Stock Exchange is down 1.3%. This after Russian drones that entered Poland's airspace were shot down by Poland. It's believed to be the first time a NATO country has fired on Russian assets since Russia invaded Ukraine. Prior to that, President Trump has called on China, had called on China and India to apply 100% tariffs on Russian imports to pressure Russia on Ukraine. Here, Dow futures are down 0.2%. S&P futures are the other way up 0.2%. With wholesale inflation due later today and consumer price index data covering August due tomorrow, the 10-year Treasury is down, pushing the benchmark rate up to 4.09%. The Marketplace team has a free newsletter, The Daily Wrap. It brings all the day's news and numbers to your inbox on weekday evenings, a 5-minute Marketplace briefing. Read the latest issue and you can sign up for the Marketplace Daily Wrap, marketplace.org/subscribe.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Odoo, offering software that provides building blocks for creating a custom software suite. Odoo, what businesses need. And by Avalara, providing cloud-based solutions for businesses to manage property tax compliance. Learn more at avalara.com/property tax.
It is a record high year for electric bills. In the first 6 months of the year, rate increases requested or put into force total about $29 billion nationwide, according to the consumer advocacy group Power Lines. Now, part of this is rising demand for power and the need to maintain aging infrastructure. Jana Rose Schleiss reports on the business models of utility companies that help drive these price hikes.
Demand for electricity is rising, in part due to the expansion of power-hungry data centers. Many utilities are investing in new power plants, the cost of which ultimately get passed on to customers. When consumers don't like the price of gas, groceries, or a haircut, they can shop around for a cheaper option. Not so for electricity. Richard Hirsch at Virginia Tech says that's because utilities have pretty much always been monopolies.
In 1882, Thomas Edison built the first electric power plant that provided a large number of customers electricity in New York City.
In the early days of electricity, companies built power plants in cities with large customer bases.
The economies of scale in the utility industry enabled companies to produce cheaper and cheaper electricity and charge lower and lower rates in a way that would not occur in a competitive system.
To prevent price gouging, electrical utilities are regulated in each state. When companies want to raise prices or recoup investment costs, they present their case before regulators. And because utilities provide something that we all need, regulators want them to be viable.
To make sure that utility companies actually earned enough money to stay in business.
Without using their monopoly power to exploit their customers. These natural monopolies occur in industries that require large upfront investments. Severin Borenstein at UC Berkeley says there are also mechanical reasons it's easier for just one company to make or deliver electricity. Power lines.
If somebody is already running wires down your street, it's both economically inefficient and just a bad business idea to say we're going to spend a lot of money to do exactly what they're doing already.
The high costs of upgrading and repairing that aging infrastructure, which is especially vulnerable to increasingly severe weather, is one of the many factors causing high utility bills this year. In other industries, competition can lead to lower prices for customers. That hasn't yet been the case with utilities. Because of that infrastructure need, Borenstein says a retail market for electricity isn't likely anytime soon.
So basically, we need wires that go to everybody's house or company. And as long as that's the case, we're going to have monopoly utilities.
That used to be the case for phone lines, but cell technology meant more consumer choice for providers. But we haven't figured out how to get there with electricity just yet. I'm Jana Rose Schleiss for Marketplace.
And in our Breakfast of Champions category, there's news of a new Girl Scout cookie coming in 2026. Rocky Road ice cream inspired with chocolate and marshmallow in there. That seems like a lot. Just have one, not 17. In Los Angeles, I'm David Brancaccio, Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. United Way of Bemidji Area, in partnership with the Bemidji Trap and Skeet Club, will hold a trap tournament Thursday, September 25th, The registration deadline is September 22nd. Find more details at United Way, Bemidji. Thanks to our listeners, we've raised over $162,000 during this crisis caused by federal cuts to public media. KXC is working hard to keep the programming you love going strong. Every action helps. Donate or share our work. Visit KAXC.com.